welcome to Aerian Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 2nd of March 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at RadioAlbion.com. Well, it's the start of another week, and we are almost into the springtime here, and I'm very pleased to say that we are welcoming back my co-host Max Musson from Western Spring today. Max, good afternoon to you, sir. How are you doing?
Good afternoon. Yes, very well. It is a very, it has been a spring day today. We've had lots of sunshine. I've been outside, got a lot of exercise, had a good day as well in terms of practicing on my piano, because I don't know whether I've mentioned before, but I've decided to learn to play the piano, and I'm self-teaching myself at the moment and beating out a few rudimentary tunes, but nothing to brag about so far.
Oh, it's always good to learn new things, isn't it? And new skills.
And it's all a matter of muscle memory in terms of the sequences in which you hit the keys. And what I'm finding is that I'm in danger of giving myself repetitive strain injury by practicing too much, I think.
what do the rest of your household think of your practicing?
Their comments are that it sounds quite tuneful, so I'm taking that as very positive.
That is very positive indeed. And I would encourage all our listeners to try learning a musical instrument if they don't already. We are a very creative race, and that's one of the things that we excel in is writing music. All right, let's get into some of these prominent news stories that we've got this week. And this first one really stood out to me because it just confirms everything that we've been saying. A major survey of the British television industry has found that, contrary to what Lenny Henry says, gays and ethnic minorities are actually massively overrepresented. The Creative Diversity Network published its own report after surveying over 30,000 diversity forms relating to over 600,000 TV production contributions. The CDN found that black and minority ethnic on-screen representation is a remarkable 23%, almost twice as much as their percentage of the British population, which is estimated at 14%. Gays also get far more on-screen roles than their percentage of the population, which used to be estimated at 1% and is now claimed to be 6%. They account for 10% on the BBC, 10.5% on ITV, 13.1% on Channel 4, an astonishing 18.1% on Channel 5, and 7.6% at Sky. Gays were similarly overrepresented off-screen, accounting for 14.7%, 14.1%, 16.1%, 12.5%, and 10.4% of all off-screen jobs at the same five broadcasters. Women also enjoyed stronger representation, accounting for 52.4% of on-screen contributions and 53.7% of off-screen contributions, while actually accounting for just 47% of the working age population. Still, the foreword to the report suggests that there is in fact more work to do behind the scenes, lamenting that women and minorities remain absent from many senior creative roles. For example, the report laments that while females dominate contributions in some production roles, such as commissioning editor, 64%, head of production, 85%, and in hair and makeup, 98%, they are still underrepresented in other areas of production, such as camera, 17%, sound, 15%, and lighting, 3%, and in some senior roles, for example, writer, 38%, and director, 26%. And of course, all those last ones just reflect the skill set that males have and the skill set that females have. Of course, men are going to be better at lighting and sound and organizing things, and women are going to be better at hair and makeup, and possibly at commissioning, because women are very, very sociable creatures. So they're going to be good at looking for things that are going to appeal to people. But the real shocking thing about this is the amount of black and minority ethnics that we are seeing on screen now. And I think really they've underrepresented the numbers here, because when you look at things like news shows, you're talking 60% are going to be black. I mean, I watch BBC News 24 all the time during the day while I'm working on Radio Albion stuff, and just about every newsreader is black, especially over the weekend. You've got black ones, you've got Indian ones. All of the weather forecasters now, with the exception of about two or three, are black and non-white. All in all the adverts, you're seeing mixed race couples there. You never see a white couple. If you watch something like EastEnders, you will never see white women ever going out with anybody that's actually white. They always end up choosing partners who are Pakistani or partners who are Negro. This overrepresentation of this is actually helpful to us because everybody is noticing it. People that aren't nationalists are noticing this. And this report confirms that, and yet they still have the cheek to say that there's more work to do, which again just proves what we say, that diversity just means replacing everybody who's white, because they've already replaced the amount of white people for the percentage of the black and minority ethnics in the population. They've almost doubled that, and they're saying, oh, we still need to do more. You know, they won't be happy until there's no white people left. Max, what do you make of this?
Well, I agree 100% really with much of what you said. I don't know that we can say that women necessarily aren't going to be as good at things like lighting and that type of thing. I think that there are some women who are very skilled artistically, and there's no reason why they shouldn't be just as skilled in terms of lighting and set creation.
Well, it's technical, isn't it?
But
technical stuff is what I mean. Like, you know, engineering sort of stuff. It's technical, that side of it, rather than creative. That's why I was suggesting it was, you know, probably more a male sort of thing to do. Don't you think?
Okay. But I think that by and large what you said and the outcome of this survey is entirely accurate. You know, Lenny Henry a while back stated that ethnic minorities in particular were underrepresented on TV, and at the time I couldn't believe he was actually seriously suggesting that, because you know they were at that point already overrepresented in my opinion, and since then and I would say that over the last 12 months, particularly over the last 6 months, the percentage of people appearing on television in various programs, whether they happen to be news programs or even any other kind of drama programs or whatever, the percentage of people who are from ethnic minorities has absolutely mushroomed. And as you say, we're now in a situation where there are disproportionate numbers of ethnic minorities reading the news to us. There are people from ethnic minorities are being put into programs that are historical dramas where there wouldn't have been anybody who is from an ethnic minority, because the country would have been at that time 99.9% white, and there just wouldn't have been any ethnic minorities worth speaking about. And yet at every step and turn along the way, whenever it's possible, they include a character who is from an ethnic minority. And it's noticeable now as well that with regard to things like sports commentators, it's quite rare now, apart from Gary Lineker, of course, but it's quite rare now to find a sports commentator in a news program who isn't a woman. And that's fine as far as the vast majority of sports are concerned. But in terms of soccer, where traditionally there would have been an almost entirely men only sport in terms of appreciation, we're now in a situation where, you know, granted that there are now ladies soccer teams, and so therefore there perhaps should be 50% of the soccer commentators should be women and 50% of them should be men. We're now in a situation where it's quite rare to see a male soccer commentator on television. Also, in terms of adverts, as you say, whenever a married couple or a couple are featured, they are invariably a mixed race couple. But there have now started to be some adverts on television where every single person in the advert is from an ethnic minority, and there isn't a single white person in the advert. And those adverts where there tend to be almost entirely white people in those adverts are quite few and far between now, and they tend to be predominantly adverts for things like head lice and creams for vaginal itching and things like that, the sort of things that most people wouldn't really want to be associated with. And so it looks as though it's intended to try and give the impression that only white people suffer from embarrassing physical ailments and ethnic minorities don't. That seems to be the message that they're trying to give out. And I think that this survey and the reports come out is long overdue, and it's something that I think that senior executives within the media need to take note of, really, because otherwise there is going to be this massive disconnect between what average people see in their daily lives and what is being presented on television. And if that disconnect gets too great, then what's going to happen is that people are just going to become entirely disenchanted with what's shown on the television. And already, I think there's going to be a television program soon, perhaps even a series of television programs featuring Laura Koonsberg, where she's talking about the way in which there's been a dramatic loss of confidence on the part of the public in people in authority in this country, particularly politicians, but senior civil servants and people in the media. And I think that if they continue with this political correct brainwashing that is now becoming so obvious that it probably is having the opposite effect that it's intended to, then what's going to happen is that this loss of respect for people in authority is going to increase, and the more and more people are going to become cynical, more and more people are going to start looking for leadership somewhere else. And so that could be good for us, but it's probably not what the what the authorities actually want, and certainly not what the people in the media probably want. But we'll have to watch and see what happens.
Yeah, I think the BBC have actually got a department and they've pledged to increase the diversity even more and get even more black and minority ethnic folks into these dramas. And you brought up the historical reenactments that they have there. And, you know, there may have been a few blacks working on the docks, because we had the British Empire, we had ships, we had trade between here and India, and on those ships sometimes there were black or Indian workers. They didn't actually live in Britain, they just worked on these ships. And the BBC will use that excuse that because there were some of these black dock workers in Liverpool, that means we can replace a Henry VIII with a Negro, or we can replace anybody in our history with black folks. I mean, they've had Friar Tuck as a black guy. They've had people involved with King Arthur as blacks and non-whites. They showed the fall of Troy and they had blacks and non-whites. It's absolutely ridiculous. And you brought up the sports commentators there. I think they have a transsexual sports commentator called Jane Dougal. And next time you watch the BBC in the mornings, you might happen to catch a glimpse of this Jane Dougal. And I think it's definitely a man that's had possibly had some kind of operation there. But besides that, all the experts they now have on that BBC sofa on the BBC breakfast time, it's always women. They will never have a male expert on there anymore. I mean, even in things to do with things like physics and space and technical things that women aren't going to be that good at explaining, there aren't going to be that many women involved in those fields, and they will always have women explaining it. I have noticed that with this coronavirus thing now, that they have had more men explaining it. And I guess because, you know, that's a serious issue, and we want to get the best advice. We're not concerned about social engineering with that. We just want the best advice. And social engineering is what's going on with these adverts, because it's quite clear they're not trying to target their advertisements at the group with the most money, because the group with the most money is not black and minority ethnic. The group with the most money is white people. And yet these adverts that feature black families are being aimed at white folks. Places like Waitrose, things that, normally you would expect white families to be interested in, to be the target of these adverts, and yet they will put all these black folks in there. It's like the Gillette advert. Instead of targeting that to butch, burly men who want to shave, you know, they put all this feminine, transsexual stuff in there. And, you know, the sales of Gillette just plummet. and yet they still have that that advertisement out there. So it's quite obvious that these advertisement companies, they're run by these progressive liberals, and they're more interested in trying to change the public perception than they are in actually selling the products. It makes you question whether that is actually the real purpose of this advertising, is to change public perceptions. But I think it just rubs people up the wrong way. They just get fed up of it. They get what's termed Negro fatigue with seeing them all the time. And the other side of this is they tend to put incompetent ones in there as well, who aren't any good at what they're doing, and they can't read their lines because of the low average IQ they have. So I've noticed they have a very, very fast turnover rate with black comedians or black commentators, because, you know, they always turn out, most of the time, they turn out to be not very good. So they replace them with another one very fast as well. It's, you were about to say something there, Max?
Well, I was just going to say that there was the Scandinavian Airlines, and I'm not sure which company it is, so I won't actually guess.
SAS, SAS, yeah. Go on, it's SAS.
They produced an advert where they were basically saying that there, I think it was Sweden, isn't it? And I think they were basically saying that there is no such thing as a Swede. There's nothing that the Swedes have invented. Everything that the Swedes have, they've copied from somebody else. That Swedes have got no cuisine. The Swedes have got no culture. And the advert was, I really don't know quite what they were trying to convey with this advert, because it had really nothing to do with flying. I think it was basically to say to people that if you want to have an interesting holiday, you've got to fly away to a different country, because there's nothing interesting in Sweden that is actually Swedish. That was kind of like the message that they were giving out. But that message went down like a lead balloon. And what that happened was that where this this video was posted online, after about an hour, it had something like about 10 likes, but had about 600 dislikes. And then the number of dislikes just grew and grew exponentially, to the point where the airline was so embarrassed, they took the advert down and then modified it before putting it back up again, but then put it back up again with no comments allowed. So that really is an indication that, hinting at earlier on, or stating earlier on, about the public losing respect for the authorities and the media is already happening, basically. It is cultural appropriation in many cases, particularly where a historical character that is known to have been a white person is portrayed in a historical drama as being black. If it was the other way around, if somebody did a film about the life and times of Martin Luther King and they had a white actor playing the part of Martin Luther King, then if the actor blacked up to make himself look like more like Martin Luther King, then he would be accused of blackface, and he would be drummed out of the acting fraternity for that. Whereas if the actor appeared without blacking his face up, then he would just be scathingly criticized for not actually looking anything like Martin Luther King. And it would be described as cultural appropriation. And it is cultural appropriation the other way round as well. And we've had situations where there's been speculation as to whether James Bond will be a black man next time round. Apparently the next James Bond film is still going to feature, I can't remember what the white actor's name is now, but they're going to continue to feature him as James Bond. But I believe there is going to be a black actress playing a co-investigator or a co-agent with James Bond, and she's going to be taking over the number 007. So there's going to be a black 007, but James Bond is still white for the time being. But this again is cultural appropriation. I'm sure it's just a step along the way towards a situation where those in the media that have control over these things will eventually try to have a black James Bond, even though James Bond in all of the books has been portrayed as white. And we're in a situation now where even characters like Doctor Who, a children's character, has now been, I think the next regeneration of Doctor Who is going to be a black woman. We've already had a white woman who was like the first female Doctor Who, and
it's totally crashed the ratings. That's totally crashed the ratings. You know,
I think the thing that actress excels at is running around with a vacant look on her face, to be quite honest. And it certainly hasn't added anything to the role of Doctor Who, and I doubt very much that these further politically correct alterations to the Doctor Who format will have any beneficial effect either.
I think that's the correct response to it. Don't watch it so that the ratings are crashed. When they put out things like the airlines advert, then everybody pile in there and vote it down. I mean, that was quite incredible. It has to be the most ratioed YouTube ever produced, and it forced them to remove it. There were questions asked in the Danish parliament by the Danish People's Party, and eventually they tried to claim they were the victims. They said that the far right had phoned in a bomb threat. Basically, it was just so offensive. I mean, that really takes it to the extreme levels, but I think we're going to see more and more of that, and that's the response we need to have. Just don't watch it. And downvote it whenever you get a chance, and say, we don't want this. We're sick and tired of seeing ourselves replaced in our own countries by these people, and we don't want to see ourselves replaced on the television either. You know, there's some good examples that you brought up there, Max. Another news story that's currently big news over here at the moment is the Priti Patel bullying scandal. Priti Patel is our Home Secretary, and the mainstream press really seem to hate her. They're saying she's really against immigration, but her immigration policy isn't that harsh. It's it's this points-based system, but she does seem to be better to me, definitely better than Amber Rudd, probably going to be better than Theresa May. This seems to be why the mainstream media hates her, and this head of the Home Office Civil Service has now resigned and accused her of being a bully. I mean, it's just laughable. She's 4 foot tall. A 4 foot tall Indian woman has been bullying a 6 foot tall head of the Home Office Civil Service. It's just ridiculous. I mean, what a wet blanket this guy is. I don't see how she can be bullying anybody. And the point is, the Home Office Civil Service, I mean, that is the deep state. And that is what the Conservatives and Dominic Cummings have said. They want to put that right, because they're all leftists in there, and they were the ones that were throwing a spanner in the works for Brexit, and they want to make changes. And this guy who was the head of the Home Office Civil Service, he was obviously getting in the way of this. And he was also linked to various leaks that have happened in the past. And apparently he had a name for being, lots of calamities happening around him. I think what Boris Johnson's doing with these Indian appointments is trying to protect himself from being accused of being racist. So what I think is going on there is when Priti Patel brings out this immigration points-based policy, she can't get accused of being racist by the press. And I think maybe this is the same thing with this Rishi Sunak that he's put in there as Chancellor. And it does seem to have worked a treat, because they haven't been able to call her racist, but what they're doing now is they're accusing her of being a bully. And there is criticism of her for going to Israel and meeting with Israel's leaders without telling the Conservative Party that that's what she was doing. And to be honest, I mean, that is what the Conservative Party do all the time. It was just that she didn't actually inform them of what she was doing. I don't think she's a spy for the Zionists or anything like that. And they all support Israel, so I'm not inclined to hold that against her. And she is an Indian, and I'd much prefer to have an Indian than an African there, just because, some of them do have a very high IQ. So I'm in two minds about Priti Patel. I'm not against her. I'm not for her. But I'd like to put across this different view to the mainstream media. The very fact that they hate her says to me that maybe she's not so bad. But what do you make of this scandal, the Priti Patel bullying scandal, Max?
Well, I wouldn't state that just because the mainstream media don't like Priti Patel, that's reason for us to like her. She seems to have experienced accelerated promotion through the ranks of politicians in this country. I think she was only elected as an MP about 10 years ago, And she's been through a number of cabinet positions and now is the head of the Home Office. And that's a pretty sort of meteoric rise by anybody's standards. And I think that it's sad that a government has to pack its ranks with lots of ethnic minorities just simply in order to dispel any accusations that the government is racist. It's doing the thing which is going to accelerate the culture, accelerate the dispossession of our native people faster than anything else that they could do effectively. I think that as far as Priti Patel is concerned, the visits to Israel, I think they were kind of interpreted as perhaps as her trying to pave the way for her to become the next Conservative leader, and she certainly seems to be somebody who is driven by a very intense ambition. I think she holds Margaret Thatcher as her role model. And I think that she's aiming to become the first Indian Prime Minister of Great Britain. These are the kind of factors that are at play there. And I think that if a politician is using, is arranging meetings with the heads of state of foreign nations in order perhaps to, I'm not saying that necessarily she was doing this, but if it's suspected that they're doing that in order to gain influence in order to advance their career, then this is the sort of thing that the Democrats have been leveling against Donald Trump about using the influence of foreign governments in order to advance your own political cause. And so I would say that criticism the criticism of Priti Patel could be well founded. I don't know, but they are the sort of factors at play here, I think. And so it's a situation that we need to watch. I wouldn't like to speculate as to whether Priti Patel will make a better Home Secretary than Amber Rudd or Theresa May. They're all people who are opposed to our cause, and we need to be suspicious of them all.
Too early to tell, I guess. I mean, I'm just very, very against Theresa May and Amber Rudd. I mean, Theresa May presided over the biggest invasion of Britain since the Norman invasion. And Amber Rudd, you know, wanted to make nationalist organisations into terrorist organisations, and they banned a lot of people from coming into Britain to speak. They banned journalists from coming into Britain to interview Tommy Robinson. So we'll have to see what Priti Patel does. You can say that Indians are racially aware. I mean, they have a caste system over there, which is basically just based on degradation of color. So they do, and they understand that originally they were white once, and most of them stick to their own kind. They don't want to pollute white people's DNA. In my experience, they are quite racial. So I prefer to have her in that position than somebody like Sajid Javid, who is also a Muslim. It's not good that so much of his cabinet is non-white, but unfortunately, the world that we live in now, that's the sort of thing we have to put up with. And it already has shielded them from accusations of racism with this new immigration policy, which doesn't go nearly far enough. I mean, plenty of people have pointed out this points-based system is still going to replace white workers, isn't it? It's just that it's going to be the more intelligent white workers rather than the lower intelligence white workers. It could be of benefit to white people who need care, because instead of being cared by non-whites, there's a higher chance that they will actually be cared for by whites now, and the carers industry will have to put the wages up, which is a good thing. You know, it's a very important job looking after our old people, and we don't want people with low skills that don't care about our people that are looking after them. There are so many scandalous news reports of our elderly being mistreated by these people that are paid low wages, that have been imported from the third world. It's a good thing if we can get some white people in there doing that job, and if we can get their wages up. And we also had Rishi Sunak replacing Sajid Javid as Chancellor, and I think that was probably more to do with Rishi Sunak doing what Boris Johnson told him to do, and Sajid Javid seemed to be very aligned with the civil service again, that were, because he was told to sack his civil service, and he said, no, I'll go along with them, basically. So I think what you've got there is Boris Johnson trying to clean out these liberal types, and Dominic Cummings as well, who, don't forget, took on that guy the other week that was a eugenicist and a race realist. And Dominic Cummings knew that, because all this guy's comments were on Dominic Cummings' blog. So he was well aware of it, which, you know, it says to me that Dominic Cummings is aware of the way that the world is, and that's why the press hates him. And, you know, maybe he'll turn the Conservatives around in another direction. But there was another news story as well, a very important news story that's making the rounds at the moment, and that is the coronavirus. And we've had our first British death, and the NHS are saying it could be 1 in 10 could be hospitalised by it. And as we're recording today, we've just been told there's a 20th patient has been confirmed, and one of them actually caught the virus on British soil, which is a bit alarming, because it says that it's now making its way out there among the population. Max, what are your thoughts on the coronavirus epidemic?
The coronavirus is something which appears overall not to be a lot more deadly than just the common flu, although strangely it seems to have a mortality impact that impacts far more on elderly people than it does on young people. So whereas flu, for example, common flu and other viruses of this sort that have spread around the world, where they tend to have a kind of a U-shaped profile, where there's a high incidence of deaths amongst very young children, small babies and things of that sort, and also a higher level of deaths amongst the elderly that catch these diseases. With the coronavirus, it appears that it doesn't actually affect children very much at all. In fact, lots of children have tested positive for coronavirus and have then gone on to recover without actually experiencing any discernible symptoms whatsoever. And so it would appear to be something which worsens with age, and that's an interesting factor. I think I saw statistics today that was saying that the mortality rate amongst people below the age of 10 was a quarter of 1%, that amongst people who are older than 10 but younger than, I don't know, there was an increase in scale anyway. And I think that the highest scale, which was people above the age of 60, I think it was something like a 3.7% mortality rate. And I think it went up to something like about a 6% mortality rate for people over the age of 80. So, you know, at a 6% mortality rate, that would tend to suggest that slightly more than 1 in 20 80-year-olds that contract the virus are likely to die, and at a sort of 3.7%, it's like a 1 in 25 mortality rate amongst people over the age of 60. So it does look as though it might have a different impact if it becomes widespread than other viruses have done in the past. And so for people, particularly the elderly, it will be a great cause of concern. One of the things that I think is interesting is that the virus, the origins of the virus have been variously attributed to bats and pangolins, which are both creatures that are eaten by the Chinese in their kind of weird meat markets that they seem to have. But another factor in this whole thing is that in Wuhan city itself, allegedly only a stone's throw away from the meat market where they believe the virus began, is China's version of the Porton Down laboratories that we have here in the UK, which is a laboratory which tests and carries out investigations, etc., and stores specimens of highly toxic substances and highly deadly viruses. And so there is, I think that, you know, people very often say there's no such thing as a coincidence. And for this virus to, the outbreak of this virus to start in Wuhan, and for Wuhan to be the only place in China where they've got a laboratory that harbors these kind of viruses and that tries to manufacture these kind of viruses, that's just too much of a coincidence in my view. And so I would say there's quite a high probability that this is a virus that was perhaps introduced to bats within the laboratory situation, and at the end of the day, when a number of dead bats that whose usefulness had expired were going to be perhaps sent to an incinerator, that a poor member of staff perhaps thought, well, the meat market's just down the road, I'll take these down there and we'll sell them off to the Chinese public. Something of that sort may turn out to be the cause of the virus. And if it is, then what it suggests really is that there needs to be a radical rethink in China about the kind of food that they approve of people eating, and the security at this experimental establishment, etc. And something obviously needs to be done to make sure this sort of thing doesn't happen again. I think that there are all sorts of videos circulating on the internet. There's all sorts of stories circulating about weird and wonderful things that the Chinese people eat. I've seen some of them. They look very convincingly authentic to me. I think that, as I say, there needs to be a bit of a rethink on the part of the Chinese government as to what sort of foodstuffs they allow to be sold as to the public as food in China. So as far as the coronavirus is concerned, it looks as if the virus is being contained to a great extent in China. It doesn't appear to be spreading wholesale amongst the Chinese population. I think the numbers of new people infected seems to be falling in China, although the numbers of new people infected are rising in other parts of the world, which is really kind of what you'd have expected, really, with a timeline of a virus of this sort. So hopefully our authorities, and hopefully the medical authorities in other countries that where there have been outbreaks of the virus, will start to get on top of it in the same way that the Chinese had done. I think one of the things that's been most impressive about the Chinese is that when the virus did break out, they requisitioned large pieces of land, and in a matter of a week built 1,000-bed hospitals. I think they've got several of these now. And that is a remarkable feat on the part of the Chinese government, and they're to be commended on that. And I think that I would hope that elsewhere in the world, that some governments in countries where there have been outbreaks will be similarly determined to make sure that they have the facilities to fight the virus and to contain it in the same way that the Chinese have done.
Yeah, it's concerning that it seems to have flared up in Italy. And also just a final point there, the Jews in Israel have said that they're only a matter of weeks away from having a vaccination to it. And just by chance, they happen to have been working on coronaviruses for the last couple of years and using that particular one, or one very close to it, as their test sample for a new form of vaccination, which is going to be taken orally rather than through the injection route. So there will be a vaccine by the end of the year, and it will come from Israel. So we just got to hope that it doesn't really take hold here in Britain. You know, you've got to worry about the elderly here. It could just turn out to be a scare, a flash in the pan thing, that we need to be prepared for it. And Britain would have problems requisitioning land and building a hospital within a week, just because the government doesn't have the sort of power here that the government in China does. I mean, that's what you can do when you've got a nationalist authoritarian government.
I think the Civil Contingencies Act would allow the government to requisition land in the same way. So I think that we would be able to do it if the government are of a mind to do it.
Yeah, that was the most impressive thing about this, wasn't it? The way they just got that hospital built, watching the slow time-lapse photography as all the diggers were there. It was quite incredible. to see. They're just saying there's a further 12 cases now. It's taken off in a school in Britain. So hopefully they'll be able to contain it. Anyway, we've got a greatest Britain to talk about today as well. Probably the most controversial one that we have had yet, I think. And that is Cecil Rhodes. And a lot of people criticise Cecil Rhodes in the conspiracy theorist movement. He did have links with the Rothschilds, but he was a superb British nationalist. I mean, he loved Britain. He worked tirelessly for the British Empire. And, you know, I mean, you cannot say that the guy was not a nationalist. Everything he did was all about Britain. He had a secret will where he wanted to bring America back into the British Empire. And the reason why he thought this was because he thought the British people were the best race to rule the world, because we were the most just, the most charitable, the most decent. And obviously everybody else would be better off being ruled by us rather than by themselves. That was his logic, you know, and, you know, he may have been right in that. And he was certainly one of our most well-known sons of Britain. And he had a huge effect over there in Africa. So he's going to be our greatest Briton for the next week or so. It'll probably take a couple of weeks to get through all of this. Max, you were the one that actually first said Cecil Rhodes to me. So before we get into it, do you want to just give a few comments about the man himself and what you think of him personally?
Well, I think Cecil Rhodes grew up at a time when there was a fair amount of social change in this country, where there was a move to create an empire, effectively, and really the impetus behind creating the empire came from the lack of social mobility that exists existed within European societies. And what we had was a slightly different approach. Whereas on the continent, the people who could be regarded as the nobility, they were people who were a caste of people who had what could be described as exalted birth, rather than people that didn't. And on the continent, there tended to be a move towards where people from the citizenry wanted to improve their situation. They improved their situation by working to enter into the bureaucracy that formed the organizing caste within European society. And this is kind of reflected in the situation with the European Union, where what you've got within the European Union is it's a bureaucratic tyranny as an organization, where everything is controlled and where working from Roman law. Roman law posits that everything is illegal unless a law is passed that permits it as something which is legal. And that differs diametrically from English common law, where, as far as English common law is concerned, everything is legal unless there is a law passed that bans it. And so as far as the citizenry on the continent were concerned, the way for them to advance themselves was through this bureaucratic system where they worked their way from position to position in order to climb as high as they could. Whereas as far as people in the UK were concerned, although they couldn't necessarily enter the nobility because they weren't of exalted birth, they could create an aristocracy, which is an upper caste distinguished by its traditions and its behavior. And so that was really what formed within Britain, where people tried to advance themselves. This aristocratic class grew up, and the aristocratic class was distinguished in that it is a class of people that sent their children to the public schools that exist and through the public school system in this country, where their children were, particularly the boys, were trained so that they would experience an exclusive Spartan public school kind of environment, that they would imbibe attitudes of leadership and courage and sportsmanship, team play, self-sacrifice, a disdain for physical comfort, and a devotion to duty, and that they would seek to fill their time with a great deal of unpaid work. They would volunteer to become justices of the peace. They would volunteer to take part as within non-governmental organizations, etc. And so this is a kind of like the background that existed. And then what was thrown into the mix beyond that was that an individual came along called John Ruskin, who was elevated to the chair of fine arts in Oxford. And Ruskin was a social radical, and Ruskin was a person from a kind of a humanist background, and he passionately believed in the superiority of British culture and our way of life, but he focused on the downtrodden people within our society who were the ones who weren't able to progress up through and were able to benefit from social mobility, and he spoke a lot about the sort of Dickensian conditions that existed in Britain at the time, and he as a humanist extended the rights that he wanted to accord to the sort of the lower class working people. He extended the rights that he wanted those to enjoy to the downtrodden people, as he saw it, from around the world as well. And so as far as the empire was concerned, you had this this class of people who were being churned out by the thousands by the public school system, who were the right kind of people to go out and build an empire. But at the same time, within the school system that was then influenced by Ruskin, you had those people subsequently imbued with a humanistic outlook on life, where they extended the privileges of our civilization, and wanted to extend the privileges of our civilization to everybody around the world. And what you had in the UK as well was a system of primogeniture, where as far as land was concerned, when parents died, they would leave their land to their oldest son, and the younger sons would be the ones who would have to go out into the world and make their own way. And so these formed a driving force within the empire. And as far as Cecil Rhodes was concerned, he was one of these people, and he attended Oxford, and he went to some lectures by John Ruskin. And he is known to have handwritten a text of the very first speech that he heard made by John Ruskin, and he is known to have carried that handwritten text around with him for the next decade. And so that obviously was something that had a great impact on him. So when he got out to Africa, he was full of enthusiasm for the British Empire, full of enthusiasm for the British way of life, had a belief that we were the race that was best suited to ruling the world, and that the system that we had created in the British Empire should be extended throughout the entire world, but also had the notion that part of his mission was to uplift the peoples the peoples of the empire, and to give them the same opportunities that would be given to British people. And so he wasn't averse to working with non-whites, and he wasn't averse to working with Jewish financiers, because part of what was needed with all of these expeditions, as we've covered in the previous episodes, is that where somebody was going out to explore previously unexplored parts of the world, they needed the finance to do it. And one way of obtaining that finance was through wealthy people, and a disproportionate number of the wealthy people at that time, just as it is today, were Jews. And it's known, as you've already said, that Cecil Rhodes had a very good relationship with the Rothschilds, and they obviously provided him with a lot of money. And that's one of the reasons why he is viewed with suspicion by conspiracy theorists. And I think that it's It's evident that Cecil Rhodes did become a Freemason and did set up a round table group, which was intended to work behind the scenes in order to try and create a British world. And in doing so, it became it became one of the building blocks of the current global world order. I think it's just sad, really, that the vast fortune that Cecil Rhodes accumulated, despite the fact that he gave lots of his money away and funded the Rhodes Scholarships in Oxford, but that a very large portion of his money has actually been has fallen now into the hands of our enemies. In the same way that, as far as Henry Ford is concerned, Henry Ford created a vast empire, a vast fortune, which then through the Ford Foundation fell into the hands of our enemies. And so when we look back at the life of Cecil Rhodes, we look back with a certain amount of mixed emotion, really, admiring the drive and ambition that he had, having some sympathy with the political ambitions that he had, but at the same time looking back at the way in which his legacy has now been turned against us with a certain amount of sadness.
Yeah, we can lament the way it's been subverted. I mean, the whole idea was that it was going to be the British that were ruling the world, and we would teach these other races how to rule themselves. But the idea of them all coming to live in Europe and interbreeding with us, I mean, that would have horrified him. Absolutely horrified him to think of that. But that's what's going on. So I guess what you're saying there is, Max, where the people from Europe, they would grow up and try to get into this bureaucracy in Europe where we had the empire, we would be teaching these young students how to lead. We would be teaching them all the qualities, the British qualities that we were known for, justice, charity, courageousness, bravery, tough living, and we would send them out to the British Empire, to these colonies, where they would then be setting a good example to the people that were out there, so that they could then learn from these wonderful British people, these wonderful British folk, and emulate them in ruling their own country eventually. And that was the idea. So Cecil Rhodes was one of these, probably the most notable one. He was born on the 5th of July, 1853, and he died on the 26th of March, 1902. So he was only 48 years old, I believe, when he died, fairly young. He was a British businessman, mining magnate, pioneer, settler and politician in southern Africa, who served as Prime Minister of the Cape Colony from 1890 to 1896, an ardent believer in British imperialism. Rhodes and his British South Africa Company founded the Southern African Territory of Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe and Zambia, which the company named after him in 1895. South Africa's Rhodes University is also named after him. Rhodes set up the provisions of the Rhodes Scholarship, which is funded by his estate. He also put much effort towards his vision of a Cape to Cairo railway through British territory. One of Rhodes' primary motivations in politics and business was his professional belief that the Anglo-Saxon race was, to quote his will, the first race in the world. Under the reasoning that the more of the world we inhabit, the better it is for the human race, he advocated vigorous settler colonialism and ultimately a reform of the British Empire so that each component would be self-governing and represented in a single parliament in London. Ambitions such as these, juxtaposed with his policies regarding indigenous Africans in the Cape Colony, describing the country's native black population as largely in a state of barbarism, he advocated their governance as a subject race and was at the centre of actions to marginalise them politically. This has led recent critics to characterise him as a white supremacist and an architect of apartheid. And notice there's nothing there to actually contradict what he said. I mean, what are they saying? Are they saying that the African blacks in 1870, 1880, they weren't largely in a state of barbarism? I mean, they were largely in a state of barbarism. A lot of them still are in a state of barbarism today. I mean, what do you make of these first bits here, Max? Anything you want to add to this?
Well, I think barbarism is perhaps... hard word. I think probably what most social commentators today would probably say is that they were in a state of what's a good way of describing
barbarism.
It?
Barbarism.
No, not quite barbarism, because the people who originally inhabited the Cape Colony were the San, and the San were subsistence farmers, but they were nomads. They were subsistence nomads. They followed the antelope and things upon which they preyed, and just migrated round and round in large circles, in the same way that lots of animals in Africa do. You have this these television programs periodically about the Serengeti and the time in the year when all the zebra come down to cross the is it the Limpopo River, and they end up getting attacked by the crocodiles and things, you know. And it's the zebra all migrate round in a great big circular way, and I think that the San used to do the same thing, coming into South Africa and then going out through Namibia and going round and round in a big circle like that. So they were not civilized in the sense that they lived in cities or anything of that sort. They were nomads. They carried what they had on their back, and then they just made little shelters out of twigs and sticks and things when they eventually did settle somewhere. And they would not have had any writing. They would not have known about the wheel. Would have known about fire, but they didn't really know about much else than that. And they had a funny language, which was a series of clicks rather than words, in the way that other races have created language. And so they would have been regarded as being a primitive people, but primitive doesn't necessarily have to denote barbarism, because barbarism denotes violence, doesn't it? And I wouldn't have said that the San were a particularly violent people, but they were in a primitive state at the point when they were Cecil Rhodes would have encountered them. And so he would have regarded them as being largely unfit to manage land, because they would have had no, they would have had no experience of managing land. The whole concept of managing land to them means that they only live on it for a short while, and then they move off onto another bit of land that enables the original bit of land to recover from the fact that they've lived on it. So by the time they've gone around in a big circle, they come back, the land is as it was the first time they saw it. So that would be their land management. In terms of managing the land in order to develop South Africa as a country and to make raise the standard of living of the people that live there, etc., they would have no knowledge of that. And so, you know, his dismissal of them as in a state of barbarism is perhaps a harsh way of saying that they were just too primitive to be able to rule themselves properly.
Yeah. I mean, primitive is probably a better word than barbarism. The Sami that you're talking about there, were they the Bushmen? Because I know that originally when they settled South Africa, there was nobody there. And occasionally there might have been a Bushman, like the Kalahari Bushman. But then once the land had become settled and they had the farms and they had the cities there, then you got the Congoid racial type moving in from across the desert, basically. I'm trying to think of the exact name for them, the Sudanese type, you know, the not the small pygmy type, but the
Bantus,
the large black type. Yeah, Bantus, that's it, that's the word. So when you were talking about this, and they were pretty vicious. I mean, the Sami, if they're the Bushmen, then yeah, they, you know, they weren't particularly brutal, but the Bantus were, and the Zulus. So do you know which type the Sami were? Was it not Sami? That's Sami of the reindeer herders in Finland. Samu.
San, S-A-N, yeah. The San were a race of their own, effectively, because although all of the peoples, all of the indigenous people of Africa are non-white, they're not all the same race. And so what you've got is, as far as the San are concerned, they evolved in the southern part of Africa, south of the central equatorial jungle of the Congo, and then what happened was that the Negroes, in the true sense of the true Negroes, then migrated and expanded their area of inhabitation, and they went around the Congo Basin, because the Congo Basin was just regarded as too dense their way of life. But they went around and then came south down, and then they were pushing back the banter. So pushing back the San, and it's where the Negroes interbred with the San that they produced the Bantus. The Bantus are effectively a mixed race group that are half Negro and half San. And the Zulus were a Bantu tribe, and but then the Bantus pushed further, and so the area inhabited by the San became increasingly restricted, which then pushed them further south. And at the same time, white settlers were landing in the Cape Colony, finding that land was empty, that there was nobody there, and then they started to migrate north. And as they migrated north, they then encountered the San. And some of the San proved to be too resilient or too resistant to civilization on our terms, and they continued to be a nomadic people that just wandered around. But some of the San did settle with the white settlers. Some of them interbred to some extent with some of the white settlers, but also interbred with some of the Bantus, again, watering down the Negro element within them. And they are the population group that are referred to as the Cape Coloureds in South Africa now. The Cape Coloureds are a mixture of San and Negro and white. That's my sort of little potted history of the racial evolution of South Africa.
And we heard about the Cape Coloureds in the series we did on Baden-Powell as well, when you set up a special scout group for them. Well, I think that really sets the scene well for getting more into Cecil Rhodes next week. So thank you very much for coming on today, Max. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more Area in Britannia for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.